All right. Thanks. It's great to be back at USCSB and KITP. This is work with my students Christian Jepsen, Zining Ji, Brian Trendy, and also with Amos Yerong. So the motivation for this comes in part. Let's see. Do I have a pointer? What's the best way to do this? There's a pointer here. Oh, pretty good. Motivation for this comes in part from lattice models where you might have spins on different sites and they interact nearest neighbors but with some kind of power law fall off. And in fact, condensed matter physicists, since roughly the year I was born, have been considering field theory limits of such systems, starting from actions that are at least in the ballpark of what I wrote here. So you generalize this kind of discrete exchange energy to a field theory where maybe these phi A's would take values in a sphere, as indicated here. But what doesn't seem to have been done, to my surprise, is to consider the target manifold for these spins to be anything you like, and to ask what kind of renormalization, what kind of geometric renormalization might you get for the metric on the target space. And of course, one's first guess is that the beta function for the target space metric might wind up being more or less the Ricci tensor, so that the conditions of conformal invariance would be Ricci flatness, as in the case of the standard nonlinear sigma model, i.e., Dan Friedan's thesis and so forth. So indeed, the naive expectation is that we're going to find some beta function of this form, but that turns out not really to be right. We'll see that the counterterms that would generate this particular beta function do not cure the divergences that arise in this non-local action. Instead, something else cures those divergences, which I certainly didn't expect when I started.
My model would be also belong to this class. You can take R equal 1, say, or what?
There's a funny limiting process by which you can get from this kind of action to the ordinary d phi action.
Yes,
that limiting process does not conveniently commute with the calculations of loop divergences. I can do the calculations together and show how the limiting procedure really should work, but I'm not going to tell you about that today. I'm just going to say I will avoid the ordinary g d phi d phi case and tell you about new things. Okay, in n dimensions with an exponent s that you get to choose. But I'm most interested in epsilon small, because only in that case do you get something that should be something like a conformal field theory. Okay, so here's the plan. I'll first tell you about non-local phi-4 theory. In other words, we'll just warm up on a simple non-local theory where the renormalization is well understood and easy to handle. Then I'll tell you a little bit about field theories over the p-adic numbers, which was a major motivation for us to do this in the first place. And then I'll tell you more about that action that I wrote in the previous transparency, which I think really properly is the bilocal nonlinear sigma model, because it's an integral over x and y, just two positions, not many positions. And then I'll see what happens at one loop, what kind of conditions of conformal invariance you might get out of one loop, what kind of counterterms. And as I was mentioning, the counterterms that you find are not the expected ones that would give you this kind of beta function, but of a rather different sort, which I will explain when I've got more technology laid out for you. And I'll end with a speculation about how actions like the one I wrote down might be useful for describing brain actions. Okay, so this subject started in 1972 with a paper of Fisher, Ma, and Nickel, motivated very much in the way that I showed you in the first transparency. They're considering long-range interactions, and they wrote a field theory which is most conveniently thought of in momentum space for the kinetic term, This would just be the Fourier space representation of the action that I wrote on the first slide. And then you get any potential you like, maybe Z2 even, to make things straightforward. And my conventions for Fourier transforms, by the way, is to put the two pi's here. I've gradually learned that that makes a lot of formulas incredibly simpler and prettier, and also more generalizable to the p-adic numbers. So you've got this field theory to start with. It looks very much like ordinary field theory, where in ordinary field theory, you just set S equals 2. And so you have power counting that works the way you learn from any textbook on quantum field theory. In particular, that's a very familiar dimension for the scalar field phi. In terms of the number of space-time dimensions, think S equals 2, and it becomes familiar. Okay, so what do we guess should happen under the renormalization group action of this this theory? So a good guess, holding n fixed, is that when S is small, you'll find that you have only a Gaussian theory. And the reason is that the only operator, only a power of phi operator, which you could build, which is relevant and Z2 even, is phi squared itself. So you can make the theory massive if you like, but there's no other deformation you can give to it that will become important in the infrared. So this is as if you were above the upper critical dimension. But remember, what we're really doing is we're holding n fixed and we're sliding S. Then when you get to S equals 1/2 n, you arrive at something which is like the upper critical dimension. And you can do a Wilson-Fisher style analysis, in other words, a perturbative analysis of the renormalization group, and you can find that there's a new branch of fixed points that opens off of the Gaussian theory, and it comes from adding a relevant, now relevant, phi-fourth interaction. So if you start here, you turn on, in the Gaussian theory, a phi-fourth interaction, RG will march the theory up to some fixed point that looks like this, and this vertical axis is strength of coupling, more or less. So this branch of fixed points parameterized by S seems naturally to end when S equals n, because when S equals n, the scalar field becomes itself dimensionless. This is like going to the lower critical dimension, beyond which you expect there to be correlators that grow with distance rather than shrinking with distance. So on this side of S getting too large, epsilon becomes negative, and this becomes a growing power, not a shrinking power. So this is a pathological kind of correlator. Anyway, the usual story with nonlinear sigma models is that close to the lower critical dimension, you should be able to expand in 2 plus epsilon dimensions, and this is supposed to describe the theory where your potential has become very deep, and so your scalar field is stuck at the bottom of some potential, and it's on a manifold, which is Fn minus 1, and so the sigma model is supposed to be describing the strong coupling limit of the phi-fourth theory. So that's why you think nonlinear sigma models should exist in the first place. And the same arguments seem to run when you have these non-local couplings. So I think there should be such a thing as a non-local nonlinear sigma model. Now, I admit that argument is a little bit naive because you could encounter other operators which become relevant at some point along this axis, which are pure derivative operators. Let's do our best to ignore that complication. Now, the reason I want to look right away at an explicit loop calculation is that having learned field theory as local field theory, you might distrust non-local field theory reflexively and say, look, as soon as you introduce non-locality, it'll be all over the place, you'll get non-renormalizability, your theory will just be way too general. And so the first answer to that, back from the early 70s, is that this term in the action, in the Fisher-Mann-Nicol action, does not get renormalized in any way, shape, or form. It's a very strong non-renormalization theorem. It completely fails if S equals 2, fast equals 2, of course you get wave function renormalization. But when s is not an even integer, you don't. And here's an example of why. Let's just take phi cube theory to make our life as easy as possible. Then you get a Feynman diagram that looks like this. It's proportional to an integral that looks like this, so two factors of the propagator in the denominator. And what makes the whole story go is that this integral has divergences which are analytic in k squared. They're analytic in k squared. So you can get, for instance, this term, which is a mass renormalization. It adds, you know, some constant to the 1pi two-point function. So you get mass renormalization, sure. And you might get a d phi squared counter term, depending on the value of n and s. But no way in the world can you persuade a power of k to the s to appear in this divergent part of I, because I is analytic in k squared. Okay, so that is the very simplistic and...
UV divergences are local.
Yes. That depends, however, on the interactions being perfectly local. So this minor bit of non-locality does not spoil the statement that you just made. However, when we get to the non-local sigma model, the interactions are also bilocal, and all bets are off. So one of your fears might be, well, in that case, your theory won't exist. It'll be non-renormalizable. And so I guess part of the punchline of this talk is to say, no, something extra happens that's nice, that gives you counter terms that you didn't expect, that seems to make the theory renormalizable. Okay.
But it could be also non-casual, right? Because in local theory, you know, you have it for granted, right? But here it's not evident, right?
A serious concern. I'm going to dodge it for today by saying I'm doing Euclidean theories, which is certainly consistent with the original motivation of a power law statistical mechanical model. I don't have any bright ideas on how we could avoid ghosts. For a nonlinear sigma model, you would hope that the very extensive diffeomorphism symmetry might protect you a little bit, but I can't even start to add something intelligent to that. Okay, so let's take a quick detour. You'll see why in a moment, to p-adic numbers. The idea is now to have field theories defined over the p-adic numbers, but where the fields themselves, the fields phi, are real valued. So we're only changing one thing to p-adic numbers, and that is the, let's call them, the world sheet coordinates, if you like, x. What are p-adic numbers? Well, I've said it in three lines. It's not a complicated thing. You start with the set of rational numbers expressed in such a form, rational numbers whose denominator is a power of a chosen prime p. You define a norm on this set of rational numbers in a slightly non-intuitive way, judging the number of powers of p that divides a certain number x will tell you the norm or the p-adic norm of that number. And then the p-adic numbers are, by definition, the completion under that unusual norm of the subset of the rationals that I started from. That's all. I think more intuitive is this picture that I drew here for the two adic numbers. Think of the two adic numbers as being on the boundary of a bulk space, which is a tree graph. And then as you wend your way up from the distant depths of the tree graph, as you wend your way up through the tree graph toward the boundary, the way in which you turn at each step defines some binary expansion of the number on the boundary you wind up with. And if you look closely, that binary expansion terminates on the right, because there was a first moment at which you made a turn at all, but it does not terminate on the left. So two adic numbers have the unusual property that they are apparently divergent series with coefficients xr, which in that case would be 0 or 1. So you have arbitrary large powers of 2, but these series are nevertheless convergent in the sense of the two adic norm. It all sounds like something that's a little bit abstract. Axiomatically, it's just as secure as the construction of the real numbers. And it's useful for a field theorist because two-adic integration is wonderfully simple. And two-adic field theories, likewise, tend to be simpler than real field theories. So here is the fast-forward version of two-adic integration, or p-adic integration generally. The smoothest function you can make is a characteristic function of the two-adic integers. It doesn't look very smooth, but in a sort of a axiomatic sense, again, it is the smoothest thing that you can make. It is its own Fourier transform, just like a Gaussian. What you mean by Fourier transforms is expanding in plane waves, and plane waves you can define. I've plotted a plane wave here as a function of a p-adic argument. Plane waves you can define as e to the 2 pi I times a fractional part of a p-adic number, where the fractional part is, you pick some p-adic integer like this, and then the fractional part is the difference of x and it's an integer part. Or to put it a little bit more, perhaps operationally, if we have an expansion that looks like this, you can see here there's two digits after the decimal point, and then many before the decimal point. The fractional part, which is the part that determines the plane wave, is only this bit after the decimal point. So if you chop off everything else, you're chopping off the pathology of an infinite divergent sum, and so you wind up with just some rational number. So this business here is indeed a well-defined plane wave. All right. Finally, we'll get...
Z2 is two adic integers. It's not the group 0, 1.
Exactly. There's only so many symbols you can use. If I were going to write Z2, I would write Z/2Z, the quotient, additive quotient group. Okay. So we'll need integrals like this, loop integrals like this. They turn into geometric sums because you can essentially plot the function that you're interested in, this power of the momentum, as a piecewise constant function of the two-adic argument. And then you integrate it sort of by eye. You can see that its value is 2 for a rather small interval of k, and its value is 1/4 at a rather larger interval. And we can impose momentum cutoffs like I illustrated. Depending on the value of s, you can get UV divergences. Everything is easy because integration turns into ordinary summation, and you get usually geometric sums or other combinations. Well, why is that really so nice? I'm still getting to it in a sense. To spill the beans in advance, there are no derivative operators. You remember I was worrying about generating d phi squared operators? They don't even exist over the p-adics. So, just to set the stage a little further, we need Fourier transforms of momentum space propagators or their inverses. And so you need some formula like this, very much like you use in dimensional regularization. And the charming fact is that as you change what your integration space is, whether it's real or p-adic, all you have to do in this formula is change what you mean by norm, whether it's the ordinary norm or the p-adic norm, and then change what this function is. It's always some variant of a gamma function. And I've indicated here how you can define it over a real vector space or over a p-adic vector space. And now, again, the real point is that the p-adic field theories have no notion of differentiation except one that comes from really secretly integration. So if phi is a real valued function of a p-adic argument, then differentiation of it means go to Fourier space and multiply by the appropriate power of k. What else might I mean by differentiation? I could define derivatives like this, at least if s is an even integer, even over the reals. But in general, if s is not an even integer, this thing winds up being an integral expression in phi. Okay. And you can see it's very much the kind of integral that I was interested in right from the start. It's got this same denominator that I cared about. So let me just walk through one more bit of p-adic field theory, and then we'll go back to the main line. I want to do the same calculation of the one-loop diagram for p-adic field theory. Here it is. It's the ordinary phi cubed field theory. Once again, this is a real valued phi over a p-adic x. And so same arguments give you the same answer, that the renormalization due to this one-loop factor is proportional to an integrand, which has two factors of the propagator. And now you might say, well, how do you expand something like this in K? How do you make some argument similar to the argument we were talking about, that you get something analytic in K squared? Well, it's incredibly easy. It's so easy because this integrand is exactly equal to its K equals zero value, except on a compact set of L. So unless L is less than K, you'll get this equality. So this integral, its only divergent piece is this one power of lambda with no K dependence at all. In other words, any Feynman diagram you care to write, I make this a much stronger argument, any Feynman diagram you care to write, it might have a divergence, but it'll only have one, it'll only be a single power of lambda, and it'll have no K dependence. So, you know, at a stroke, we have completely verified that this is not renormalized. You don't even generate other K to the S terms. You might renormalize this, you might generate mass terms, you might generate phi-fourth terms, but nothing else happens. So that's why I say, look, p-adic field theories, they're wonderfully simple. They're almost a toy model of our usual life.
And the same thing happens with higher numbers of loops.
Yes. Yes, for essentially the same reason. One way to put it is, what do you want here? Lambda to another power times k squared? Well, k squared is a p-adic number, and it can't, therefore, add to a real quantity. So there's no candidate expression to write here. And for it to be the norm of k to some power, that doesn't make any sense because you're trying to do a Taylor extension. Anyway, this is the best argument that the loop integrand coincides with its k equals zero value, except on a compact set of loop momenta. That's a very generalizable argument.
Why don't you use dimensional regularization?
It trips you up in this case. There, usually with dimensional regularization, you find that integral dn of L divided by L dn is what you care about. And that has an infrared divergence at the same time that it has a UV divergence. In the case of these nonlinear, nonlocal sigma models, they're not matched. And if you use dimreg, which we tried, I assure you, at least I get it flat wrong. So UV cutoff seems to be the only answer that I can usefully employ.
What about Pauli without it?
Didn't try it, is the honest answer. I'm not sure what would happen.
So you're always breaking the symmetry.
Yes, that's true. That's an interesting question. We should, in principle, take a look at Pauli Velars, because there's no... It can certainly distinguish between infrared and ultraviolet. So you're right. That's a good thing to try. Okay. All right. I think I've said my piece. In the p-adic case, you only get one divergence. And maybe that wasn't so impressive when the divergence power was rather small, 1 minus the positive number. But you can do this for n-dimensional vector spaces over the p-adics. It becomes rather impressive when n is large. Okay, so where are we? We just reassured ourselves that you can include non-local terms like this in field theory without getting hurt. And the reason that you can do it is that they don't get renormalized. However, they might generalize, they might generate derivative terms of this form if such terms are relevant and if they exist. All this hinged on the fact that the interactions were entirely local, and the argument that we use for not getting renormalization of this will be broken if we put interactions into the bilocal term. In other words, if this had nonlinear parts in phi. Okay, so now we're going to turn to exactly that case and look at what loop divergences occur there. And again, we have on our minds that we're expecting to get something like a Ricci flow beta function. And I keep telling you we won't, but soon I'll have to tell you what we get instead. All right, so here is the action I really want to think about. Q is just shorthand for me. It's the arc length squared between points x and y on the target space manifold. So my notation here is that lowercase x and y are, shall we say, the world sheet coordinates. They could be p-adic, although if you prefer not to think about p-adics, then that's okay. Capital X and y are going to become phi x and phi of y. All right. I include an explicit energy scale here because I want to be able to have this thing be dimensionless under ordinary power counting, and likewise phi, I want to have dimensionless. So I'm imitating the usual strategy for analyzing nonlinear sigma models in 2 plus epsilon dimensions. Gamma is a handy parameter. Everybody includes some version of it. It's a loop counting parameter, or you might think of it as scaling the size of the manifold. I like to think of it as a loop counting parameter, so that a one loop effect will be order gamma to the 0, two loops will be order gamma to the 1, et cetera, et cetera. And if S and N are somewhat large, then if you start thinking about this, let's say for both of them approximately equal to 3, then even if this is a smooth function, even if it has a quadratic 0, you're eventually going to have trouble defining this integral. And so there has to be some notion of regularization of the integral, which amounts to adding some amount of derivative terms, if they exist, to this Lagrangian in the first place. So there's a little more than meets the eye in equation 10. But you'll see that in momentum space, life becomes simple. And so I'll go to momentum space as quickly as I can. But first, I have to really know a lot about this QXY. Let me just draw it to make sure I'm clear. I have in mind a smooth target space. I'm focusing on maps that are approximately constant, so I can use a single coordinate patch to describe all the points that I'm going to be talking about. Here's one point X, here's one point Y, and there is some geodesic that goes between them, and the length of this geodesic is d, and q is d squared. So that's probably a good diagram to put my transparencies over it next time. And I want to know, for purposes of perturbative calculations, what is an expansion of q in powers of x and y to a sufficiently high order to do whatever I need to do. And here's the answer to equation 12. The first term is obvious. If the metric were flat, this would be the end. The second term is, I think, fairly standard and familiar. It's the Riemann normal coordinate expression that follows from equation 11. And then, well, this term doesn't take a whole lot of thinking, but then you really have to work to get the sixth order terms. And sad to say, we need them. We'll see why. I've got lots of notation here. If I have two indices A1 and A2, I'll compress them into A12, and likewise with derivatives. If I have two derivatives and they're symmetrized, I'll compress them into just a grad AB.
So just what is the controls, how many terms you actually need?
You would think that you only need this term because you can already do a loop calculation here that's going to modify the metric. And yet, it turns out that field redefinitions make that modification ambiguous. So you have to go to an order that's sufficient to modify the to loop correct the quartic term in Q. So you're going to have to loop correct this term, and in order to do it, you need, so you're doing a 4-point vertex. So I could get a loop correction to the 4-point vertex this way, or I could do it this way. And so I have to go up to the sixth order. If it's just one loop, I have to go up to the sixth order. I can't do it with any fifth order vertices because there's no way to tie them together and get four left over. That's the answer. Okay, so it's just a matter now of doing an ordinary, non-local, perturbative field theory calculation. Let me go now into summary mode so as to spare you the details as much as possible. And we'll take a look later in my talk at whatever details we have room for. So the diagrammatics are a little heavy because when you have an interaction that comes from this term in the arc length squared, you've got two different kinds of fields. This would be 5x and 5y eventually. And so you should label the legs off of your vertices depending on which type of field they came from. So dots or no dots. And the kind of six-order vertices that we need are going to turn out to be these. So you can have either two dots or three. I would have liked to have done all my calculations in position space, but I had trouble tracking down the divergence structure. And like I was answering Don, what you think at first you can do is just compute the correction to the propagator because that's going to correct the metric, but no, there's field redefinitions, which are a big pain. So, indeed, even in the local nonlinear sigma model, doing it the way I'm doing it, you need to go beyond just this 2-point diagram all the way to the 4-point diagram to disambiguate field redefinitions. For the bilocal nonlinear sigma model, this is a very exceptional diagram. It has no non-local divergences. In other words, for the same reasons, almost, that we were getting a non-renormalization theorem earlier, we're going to get no non-local divergences here either. So if you stopped here, you might completely wrongly conclude that there's no non-local renormalization at all. You only radiatively generate derivative terms. That's completely fine. Okay, so this diagram, starting from a fifth-order vertex, does generate a non-local divergent term. It turns out to be uninteresting for the usual reason that you can get rid of it with a field redefinition. So you're left with these diagrams with different structures of vertices. And for technical reasons, I'm going to focus on this case only. Technical reasons are, I haven't figured out the answer for these two. We'll see as I go along that doing so would be a lot of diagrams because the diagrams individually are so decorated both with the indices of the Riemann tensors and with the dots or no dots, the diagrammatics are heavier than they look. Okay, so what is this diagram really doing? It's taking a contraction of this double derivative of the Riemann tensor with one inverse metric. The inverse metric comes from the propagator that you use to tie together the 6-point vertex into a 4-point diagram. And so when you contract this into this, you get two derivatives of the Ricci tensor plus a whole lot of quadratic terms in curvature tensors. It looks like maybe you could get something else, like for instance, maybe you could contract this with the two derivative indices and then you would get the Laplacian of the Riemann tensor, Well, that Laplacian of the Riemann tensor can be re-expressed as a linear combination of things that look like this, plus a whole bunch of things that look like this. Don't even want to think about those kind of terms. At the end of the day, we wind up with a structure of loop divergences from this type of diagram alone that has to be canceled, and the counterterm that cancels them has the following form. So you see there's these double derivatives of Ricci tensors, and there's a couple different ways to write the indices. We can either write the indices so that the double derivative indices are spread between phi of x and phi of y, or it can be that the double derivative indices are focused on just one position. So there's two distinct ways to do this, and that's really the crux of what I'm about to say next. Well, but before I do, let's notice if the Ricci tensor vanishes, so do my counterterms. So, all right, you might say, great, I got the vacuum Einstein equations, kind of, sorta, as a condition for conformal invariance, because then I don't generate any one-loop counterterms. But what about these different coefficients? Why are those so important? The reason is that a particular way of organizing the counterterms turns out to be the only thing you can do. There's the possibility of including in the action the double Laplacian of the original arc length squared. This is a perfectly target space covariant quantity because I have the target space Laplacian here. It doesn't carry any indices. There's nothing like this carrying no indices at any lower order in derivatives. I couldn't take just one grad x, for instance, without leaving a free index. And there's no other way to do it than what I wrote at quadratic order, because, for instance, I couldn't make grad x, grad y on account of the indices living in tangent spaces at different points. So this is the only thing you can do at two derivatives to modify your arc length formula, and felicitously, it gives you exactly the right coefficients to cancel the divergences that I explained to you in the previous transparency. And this is the very different thing that I hinted at earlier in the talk. This has nothing to do, apparently, with Ricci flow. It's just canceling divergences with a counterterm that wouldn't have even been available in a local theory. Now, I said a lot about field redefinitions. It's a technical subject into which I don't want to get too deeply sunk. But the way it works is that your bare coordinates are equal to the original coordinates plus some perturbative corrections that can be nonlinear functions of the renormalized coordinates. And it turns out that by choosing these u, v, and w's artfully, you can cancel, for instance, that three-loop, that three-point diagram, and cancel the divergences in this diagram completely. With no counterterms, we just use these coefficients artfully. In ordinary nonlinear sigma models, what you normally do is you have a barometric that does include a perturbative correction proportional to the Ricci tensor. And this is exactly where the beta function comes from. If you try this instead of this, you fail. We'll see it in a later transparency, so perhaps I won't explain exactly why just now. But just to say, yeah, this not only doesn't help, it can't be used. You can calculate that T0 equals 0 exactly. How am I doing on time? Oh, good. So the bare action then is some arc length squared plus some extra term, which is the double Laplacian of the arc length. And we could try to go on from here and write down a normalization group equation for the function q that appears here at a general scale. I have not quite trusted myself to do that yet because, number one, you have to work out the field redefinitions precisely, which I have not done. And number two, ideally, I would prefer to check all those Ricci squared terms before I conclude that this is a complete account of the bare action. Still, if you ask yourself, once again, the question, what is the condition for not having a correction? It is that the double Laplacian squared should at least integrate to zero. But if you compute this double Laplacian of the arc length squared starting from this formula, so just think about the double Laplacian, it means delta x squared plus delta y squared. Well, delta x squared acting on this term will just give you a constant, which you drop. Delta x squared acting on this term will just get rid of these two and leave you with this bit here and a contraction of the Riemann tensor, because you would replace this x by a g. It would be an inverse metric, because that's the Laplacian of this bilinear in x. It looks like I have extra terms here. It's because this extra bit comes from the fact that it's not just differentiating by capital X, it's the covariant derivative with respect to x, and that winds up generating one more extra term for you. Anyway, long story short, is that as before, the naive condition for conformal invariance is Ricci flatness as usual. So, you know, we can give a happy cry that we're not finding something that contradicts Einstein's equations, but I would not say we've really checked all the details. So let me take a few minutes before the end of the talk and walk you through some of the details that feed into that 6 minus 7 structure that I was so excited about, because that is the heart of the matter. Why do counterterms take the form that they do? It's a calculation that relies on all the usual ingredients. You have a quadratic free action, which has the same kind of form that we were dealing with in the earlier part of the talk, a very plain vanilla kind of action with a easy to calculate propagator. And then you've got quartic terms, which involve powers of k. So there's, instead of just two phi hats, there's four, but there's still one power of k here. And that's what these fancy scripty j phi integrals are. They're some number of factors of phi hat, where phi hat is, you know, the embedding function of the world sheet in the spacetime. There's momentum conservation, and then there's maybe some powers of k. I've left it general. This could be any function of k you like, just to keep things properly general. So what I wrote here, this quadratic action, I would write in my very abbreviated notation of j phi integrals in this form. So this gives you the propagator. Then this gives you the quartic vertex. Think of j phi as essentially phi to the fourth power with these indices and some momentum dependence. So every Feynman vertex comes from a j phi integral, and the Feynman rules look like this. These are the real Feynman rules, all factors included except for momentum conservation. So here's the quartic Feynman vertex, and then there are several sixth order Feynman vertices. These are the two that I care about. The others are bilinears in R. Fine, so all you have to do now is tie together these legs in all possible ways, worry about your field redefinitions, track all your factors. It's all straightforward. There's just a lot of detail.
Can't you again generate analytic terms? Terms that are analytic?
Yes, you can. For exactly the same reasons, you could get a subleading divergence, which is analytic in K squared. Why don't we come back to that one? I think these are a feature, not a bug. One way to say it is that they're still relevant operators when they exist as divergent terms. And so if we're looking for a conformal theory, we would tune them away in the same way that you tune away the quadratic mass term divergences in the nonlinear sigma model. That would be the glib account. Okay, so just to get the idea of how I do my business, if we start with the quartic terms where you're contracting two phis together, you're computing this Feynman diagram. It turns out that if you put the two dots in the same loop, you get a vanishing amplitude. And so an actual calculation looks like this. You do a Wick contraction, is kind of what you expect, nothing really special or surprising. And you wind up with a modification of the two-point contribution to the action with a coefficient, which is an integral that does exactly what David was talking about. It has a subleading divergence, which is k squared, if that divergence, if phi box phi is relevant. Okay, but like I said, uninteresting diagram because I can absorb it in the field redefinition. And I also am not interested in this diagram because all the k dependence comes from this subleading divergence, and this is not the kind of k dependence that I want. So having a loop where I only put one dot in the loop is useless. It does not give me the kind of non-local divergence that I need. So these loops are bad. I need loops that look like this. Those loops have a leading divergence which becomes logarithmic when s equals n. And so the first diagram, it turns out, that does what you want is this one. It has a leading divergence from what I just explained, and it has non-analytic behavior in K because you've got the dots on the external legs. So these momenta that came from the vertices, they're now external momenta. The divergence comes from an internal loop. So the combination of an internal divergence, which is at the leading order, and an external leg that gives you the k-dependence, those are the two ingredients that come together to give you a non-local divergent term. So that's what these things are all from. You get the divergence from this kind of loop, and you get the momentum dependence from the external legs. And I wrote only the first two terms because the second two that come from this diagram are once again absorbable in field redefinitions. Okay, so that was as much detail as I care to show on loop calculations. And now, to absorb them, you want to talk about the Bayer action, which includes a term of this form, proportional to the Bayer Riemann tensor. So it's phi-fourth Riemann. Riemann calculated from this metric, the Bayer metric, Riemann will wind up giving you these terms. In other words, the shift in the metric proportional to the Ricci tensor gives you a Riemann tensor, which is two derivatives of this. The two derivative structure that you get is the one I've written, where these two coefficients are equal and opposite. So that's why I said right at the start, metric renormalization doesn't help you. It produces a structure of coefficients that is useless. It's the wrong one. It's not the 6 minus 7, it's 1 minus 1. And in fact, because you get 6 minus 7 from the double Laplacian term, you can conclude that T0 equals 0. There isn't any metric renormalization. Okay, I commented down below that yes, you can get back the local nonlinear sigma model if you care to, but that's old hat. Let's not talk about it. Instead, let me just finish up here by saying that non-local quantum field theory is behaving a little bit better than you would have expected. You might have thought at the start that there's too many couplings, too much freedom, and you get a non-renormalizable theory. But instead, we're seeing counterterms come up at exactly the right moment to cure divergences. So I think there's a hint here that there's more nice structure than you might naively expect. I think I've covered most of the rest of these points pretty well, but just to say that we'd like to do a more complete RG analysis once we've worked out all the curvature bilinear terms. Let me then add one more thought, just a bit of a pie in the sky kind of thought, that just possibly these could be interesting actions from the point of view of the brains of especially M-theory, because there's a terrible problem with M2 brains. It's been appreciated since, what was it, about 1990? I think DeWitt Hoppe-Nicolai is 89. So the problem is that there's very little energy cost to going long, thin things like this on the M2 brain. The way they described it is that the M2 brain is unstable. I wouldn't quite go that far, but there is certainly a pathology, a sort of mixed infrared UV pathology for the M2 brain, which follows from the two derivative action, and which it seems to me would be at least rather different, maybe helped by writing down an action with a different structure. And, well, what structure could you pick? Higher derivative doesn't seem right because you can't even write down renormalizable things in three dimensions that way. But this kind of action, to me, has some obvious appeal that it's in the same ballpark as the actions I just explained to you in this talk. We seem to get something in the ballpark of Einstein's equations from those actions. I chose the power 6 here so that we would get something that looks as much like a conformal field theory as it can. And it involves some natural geometric quantities, now both a distance in space-time and a distance in the intrinsic world sheet metric. So I'm not claiming that I've really worked out anything more than that I'm showing on this transparency, but I'm just guessing that this might be an interesting place to start in asking, what is the M2 brain like when you get up, say, near the Planck scale, when you obviously cannot use the ordinary Nambu-Goldstone DBI type action. So then there's a question about, what about those radiatively generated derivative terms? What I wanted to add eventually, and now I will, is that I think they're a feature, not a bug. If you start with an action like this, then sure, you're going to generate extra terms, two derivative terms. And what might they be? Well, I think they would be a relevant deformation of this action, which eventually takes over in the infrared and describes the long-distance behavior of M2 brains. So I'm a long way from realizing goals like these two, but I'll just leave you with a thought that non-local field theories are nice enough that we ought to be trying to apply them widely. So thanks for listening.
Okay, maybe it's kind of like here, but let's say S larger than N, would it be UV finite theory or what?
S larger than N, so at first naively that's like being below the lower critical dimension, and so yeah, I see what you mean. It would be like quantum mechanics instead of field theory.
Yeah,
its pathologies would be more in the infrared. I see what you mean.
If you fix infrared, let's say if infrared for some reason is limited, right, then it would be just a finite.
I think I would say the pathology should be in the infrared.
Ah.
But yeah, UV finite, that does seem right. That does seem right to me.
Okay. So, but although you're doing all this in Euclidean space, what do you feel about that?
Yeah. So I think I would certainly try. Let's start with.
If you start with.
So now that you've done that.
You're going to calculate the inference and continue, analytically continue. Get rid of it.
You know, unless you're felicitously confronted with an even power like this, right? When you continue.
I was talking about the non-local sigma. I don't know about the number.
Yeah, so, but let's just take a stripped down version of this. Indeed, if S is, you know, some random number, then you're going to get a branch cut when you continue. But if S is nearly an integer, then your branch cuts are going to mostly go away. So, for instance, take n equals 3 and s equals 3, then you know, the absolute value of 3 plus 3 is 6, and so at least that continuation doesn't seem to hurt you.
S equals 3.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so right, indeed. Think of three dimensions. If we're in two dimensions or four dimensions, then we have a local model, like you know, the usual two-dimensional model. So being in an odd integer dimension, that's an interesting case to think about.
Right. But there you get a square branch cut.
There you're gonna get what?
You still have a branch cut. K cube, K absolute.
Yes. Right. I have not thought.
I mean, you started off with condensed matter physics, right, or spin chains, where you put in this non-locality in space and time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no such problem. Earth is physical system.
Right. They're common.
Yeah. But in a Lorentz invariant.
Yes, I see what you mean. But at the end of the day, when you look at the calculations I really need, I need that one.
No, but you're doing Euclidean correlation.
Right.
I'm just asking about the analytic properties and position space.
Yeah, I think you'll lose a lot. I mean, you must. You give up this one big thing. I think in what I would hope is that in position space, however, you at least in good cases, you wind up with a lot of things that are close to even powers. Even if S is an odd integer, you could still wind up with a power n plus s instead of s. So in other words, what I'm hoping is that it might not be much worse than in ordinary storage of anomalous dimensions, that you know, get some rational dimension of an operator O, and yet it has correlation functions that are perfectly well defined. You can continue them. I haven't thought further than that. I wouldn't want to offer them.
Okay. Let's take a speed again.